This is Matilda Ostow sitting with Sarah Black in her sister's house, which is also her house now because she's staying here for the next 2 months. It's May 18th, 2018, and we are recording an interview as part of the Oral History Summer School here in Hudson, New York. And Sarah and I are classmates in this workshop, and I'm conducting the interview, and I'm excited to be here. Sarah, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yes, my name is Sarah Black. Sometimes I use my middle name too, Sarah Thomas Black. I am a PhD student at the University of Georgia. I am 26 years old. I am a sort of semi. I have a New York State driver's license and a Hudson driver's license, so sometimes I like to say that I'm like a on and off Hudson resident, although I know that can be a political thing to say for some people, but I've lived here off and on since 2012, and so it's fun to have everybody in this town. I have strong identifying or a strong sense of identity with Hudson, so it's good to be here with you in my part-time kitchen.
Thank you. And can you tell me a little more broadly about where you come from?
Yeah, okay, so I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, which is, like the big city in Alabama. My parents, my mother grew up in Laurel, Mississippi, in Jones County, Mississippi. And my father grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And they met because my mom became a nurse and went to UAB for nursing school and worked in Birmingham. And my dad went to college at Auburn to get an architecture degree. And I'm pretty sure they met because he was like remodeling the emergency room or something. But it's also kind of a small town for like young singles, in the way that like small cities can be small towns. So they must have known each other. But she was Nurse Ridgway, and he was this young 6'6" architect. And so they met, and took them a long time to get together. My mom was divorced. She had been married when she was like 21 and divorced within the year. And my dad was just like shy and I don't know. There's such a odd pairing. But and so they moved, they got married and moved to this sort of suburb community called Mountain Brook, or I guess they've been living there before they got married, but and that's like a good place, has a reputation as being a good place to raise a family, because it has an incredibly celebrated school system, but it's also like an all-white school system, and not by law, but just kind of by, like originally by design, but not in any way that was like a like legalized segregation. It was more like the school system didn't. They built a school within the city. It used to be like people would go to county schools, and then they built a school in Mountain Brook. And the way I understand it is that was to strategically avoid having to comply with busing. So there were like students of color at my school system growing up, but not very many. And so my parents like aren't from there, but wound up like committing to there, and they raised us in this place called Mountain Brook, which is like, yeah, deep South, old money in a lot of ways. It's called the Tiny Kingdom sometimes, and it's like on this south side of the Red Mountain, which divides Birmingham proper from the over the mountain communities. I'm air quoting that. Because they're called that. That's like where like this all the steel production that made Birmingham what it is was like in Jones Valley on the north side of Red Mountain. And then Red Mountain was so called because it was full of like iron ore deposits, and it apparently had all of the like ingredients to make steel. And so that's why Birmingham became, they called it the Magic City, because like in the 20s it basically erupted overnight. They called it the Pittsburgh of the South. It was like this like massive steel town. No rivers, no real like kind of natural like crossroads or like intersections in the geography to make it like a classic American hub. But they built railroads. It was really the steel capacity that they had there, and this big furnace called Sloss Furnace. And yeah, so I'm from a place that's like has a really complex, and I'm not even like talked on, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with Birmingham civil rights history. And the place that I grew up, you know, I grew up in kind of the shadow of that, and in a bit of like I would think a willful detachment from that, even though more so than a lot of my friends who were from up here, like I feel like we were given a very particular education on civil rights history, and like we would do walking tours of like the marches and stuff that happened in Birmingham, and went to the 16th Street Baptist Church, which is where that bombing was when in the 60s. We went there like as elementary school students, so we took it very seriously. We didn't hide from it, but it was not the kind of place, because there was in Mountain Brook, in the suburb I grew up in, you didn't grow up feeling like the racial tension was like kind of explained or exposed to you, unless you had like, unless there were people who worked for your family, or I don't know. I'm saying that as a white person. And so that's been pretty, that dynamic has been pretty consequential in my life. The racialized like class dynamic within this community. I really identify as Southern. It's a funny thing to make sense of. It's such a loaded identity, especially living up here now, living in Hudson. And I think about, I've been having this conversation with myself these last few days about, okay, so one of the reasons I love living in Hudson so much is because there's so many really good people here and I have a lot of intimate relationships. And one of the things I love, the other place that I live where I'm a graduate student is in Athens, Georgia. And because I'm in coursework right now, I'm spending a lot of time there. And it's where I did my undergraduate education. And kind of a surprise to everyone, including me, I decided to go back there for a PhD, which is, I think, a little like, people are like, my sister was like, can't you expand your world a little bit? But I am kind of in a place where I'm actually not interested in making my world that much bigger. But Athens, very similarly, like I feel I have such rich, intimate friendships there, and I feel very good about the relationships that I have there. And so I sometimes have this fear, like if I make moves to kind of commit to either of these two, or if I make moves to not commit to either of these two places where I've spent most of my adult life, what will it be like to start over in a new community, when community is so like deeply important to me? And the kind of like day-to-day, like when you get to that point where you recognize your neighbors and you can say hi to them and they know you, you know, and it's not just like this disconnected. I'm really not happy when I don't feel connected to the people that I see every day and I don't feel like known by them, and like we have some kind of reciprocity. So starting over feels a little like, should I do that? I feel like as Americans we're encouraged to do that, but like I want to, I don't think that that would make me very happy. And that's something that's kind of on the table for me, because as a PhD student, I could go get an academic job, and I'd probably have to start fresh in a new, I'd probably have to follow a job. But then Hudson doesn't have a shit ton of economic opportunities for people. I mean, it does in some ways, but not in others, and not in ways that are necessarily just. Athens, not necessarily either. But so all that is to say is, like, I think about if I lived in Hudson and the people that I love weren't here, would I feel lonely? Or would I feel as lonely as if I lived in Athens and the people that I love in Athens weren't there? What it is about the place that makes me feel grounded? And sometimes I really think, I mean, I love the feel of the air in the Hudson Valley. I love the vistas of the Catskills. I love just seeing strangers going about their lives in this way, this like upstate New York way that's very new to me, but also feels very comfortable and like home. And I miss it when I'm not here. But God damn it, I love the South so much. And I used to, like when I lived in Georgia after college, I farmed in this place called Elberton. And I think I may have already mentioned this in front of you, but I farmed in Elberton, Georgia, and I was having to use a shovel to hand dig some garden beds, and the clay, the soil there is like so eroded from hundreds and hundreds of years of like genocide, just logging, and then slave plantation agriculture, and then just like conventional post-slave agriculture, that there's just no topsoil left, really. Or if it is, it's very hard and compacted, and it's hot, and we were in a drought. And so I like hurt my arms. I would wake up every day with numb arms for a long time because of the like farm work that I did in North Georgia. And I moved here, and you can just kind of put a shovel in the ground. Not everywhere, but it was such a different environment, and such a different, like, the rhythm of seasons is different here. You get a mud season after the snows melt. You get like things just shut down in the winter in a way I was never used to. And the summers seem to be pretty lush the whole time, whereas in the South, there's like a point in July where everything is just burnt. And the air smells cooked, and it's so weird, and it's so hot. You can feel your skin getting crispy, and yet it's also humid. And so you walk out, you were like in the air conditioning all day, and then you walk outside and your glasses fog up because the humidity just like condenses on your glasses. And so after living in Hudson for a while, I remember the first time I flew back down to Georgia or to Alabama, and from the plane, I could look out and see the clay, the red clay. They call it, like, there's a whole sort of lore around like the Alabama red clay or the Georgia red clay. It's like, it's just the clay soils like left over from the erosion, and you can see it from the sky. It's so red and so brutal. I mean, it's just like, it's just dead. And I have some friends who are from Canada who live in Georgia now, and my friend Thor is really struggling because he's from Vancouver, so it's like he's got this whole like lush mountain life up there, you know, giant trees, like temperate rainforest sort of thing, and he feels like really uncomfortable in this like deep South landscape, and I'm just like, I know it's dead, it's my dead home, and it's like the ecosystem there has been so profoundly changed by colonization and plantations. And it is like, it's like a state of constant mourning, I feel, M-O-U-R, mourning. It's like tragic, and yet you live there. And it's brutal, and there's blood on the ground, and yet you're all living there. And you're kind of, I don't know, sometimes you feel kind of in it together. Sometimes you feel worn down by it. But so what used to be the southern ecosystem is called longleaf pine. And so it's like, and this I got all from this Georgia author named Janice Ray. So it's like the southern longleaf pine is a ancient, majestic forest system. Also called piney woods or piney savanna, that used to be like 12 million acres across the South below something called the fall line, which is where the bedrock of the landscape changes from igneous rock to sedimentary rock, from like granite to like sandstone. And so in the granite, that's like the mountains, and you have gorges, and you have like deciduous hardwoods and things like that. And south of the fall line, which I've also heard some people call the gnat line because it gets like buggy in the sedimentary zone, it's more swampy. And this is like a belt that kind of sweeps across like the state of Georgia and southern Alabama. You get, before colonization, there were just basically this like like what you call like an apex ecosystem, like a for like a stable forest ecosystem, where the understory was grass and like super diverse grasses and all kinds of crazy animals that lived there, like gopher tortoises and like rare sparrows. Well, I guess they weren't rare at the time. And then above, like 3 feet off the ground, so below 3 feet off the ground was this like crazy dense understory of just like grasses, grasslands, small shrubs, but not like a thicket, not like what this kind of impenetrable forest that you might see now driving along the interstate in the south. Above it, it was like this monoculture of southern longleaf pine trees, which are these crazy psychedelic trees that are fire resistant. So that's part of how the trees, the understory was kept like clear and renewed, was lightning strike fires. And so they're fire resistant and they're enormous and they house all these incredible birds. And, oh, but what's amazing about them is they're not like in the system, they're spaced very far apart. And so it's a full forest. It's an ancient space that where you can, William Bartram wrote about how you could gallop a horse from you know, for hundreds of miles through a forest. And you just don't see that kind of stuff up here. And I've been to a preserve of that landscape. There was, like I said, there were 12 million acres and now there's like 9,000. And some of it's on like army bases and private hunting tracks. And I got to go to some and I feel like it was just like a landscape of my dreams that I didn't know I had. It was almost something out of like a C.S. Lewis book or something. It was just so surreal. And the ground was spongy. And so I think about that kind of stuff a lot, like the feeling of the landscape and the where I feel like I'm from.
I love your descriptions. Thank you. I think they're beautiful. And I'm wondering what else it means for you to know a place. Like how do you consider that you know a place or understand a place that you're living in or are from?
Oh, it's complicated. I mean, I think like sometimes I feel like a fraud when I talk about being Southern because I'm from Mountain Brook, which is a particular place where like I was a debutante, but also like it's this place that's very ruled by money. So I don't really want to like, I don't like claim Mountain Brook in a lot of ways, but I also don't try to like lie or like hide about the kinds of like the privilege I grew up in. At the same time, my parents were not particularly, we didn't have a lot of cash assets, I would say. Like, definitely plenty of social capital, and my parents had college degrees, and we owned our house, and we never went without food. And then we, on top of that, we had, like, all kinds of additional, I played on a soccer team. But I always felt like a kind of stark difference between everybody else in my community and our household. So it's hard to say. It's like, and I guess what I'm saying is that that I think I'm always kind of looking for like that feeling of belonging in a place that where it really feels kind of like authentic for me, and like, I don't know, like honoring the actual like the history of the place. The way that I feel like I honor being from Mountain Brook in a like an ethical and like the radical way that I want to is like note like trying to know the history and trying to talk about it really openly with people. And same with being from the Birmingham region is trying like that civil rights history is in some ways like totally my history. And in other ways like totally not my history. And I'm careful about like how I claim that as like a thing that I feel connected to. And it kind of depends on who I'm talking to and how I'm feeling that day. So I'd say like the ways that I feel like if I'm able to like tell a history of the place and like, I don't know if I can emote about it. I think that matters too. The food matters, but sometimes it's so hard because our communities are so kind of globalized these days, and you, which is dope in a lot of ways, but also like, especially for like white people or settler people or whatever, when you're when it doesn't, when you're like told that it's like you're not successful if you don't leave home, or like you have to leave home to make something of yourself. I think it was a really fucked up, like, sort of disruption of what it actually means to be from a place and to, like, have, like, an ethical, emotional relationship to that place. And so that's what I meant earlier when I was talking about, like, not being in a place where I'm super interested in making my world any bigger. Like, I love meeting new people and, like having new experiences and things like that. But I'm not always, like, I kind of think it's messed up to be just, like, hungry for more moving and more connection, because I think that's like part of, I don't know, I think that sets us up for having like less like rich relationships. And what I want is to be able to like, I want to suffer through the banality of living in a place for 50 years, but also have all the like the rich knowledge that comes along with it, and have that not be like some kind of sad thing, or like, I don't know. I want to be able to like witness a place change over a long period of time. So that's I identify as being from Birmingham in a lot of ways and from Mountain Brook, but I really feel like my sort of homes are here in Hudson and in Athens, because I don't think I could go back to Birmingham and stay sane. And I don't think I belong there anymore. It's also kind of too hot in a way that it's not as hot in Athens. I don't know why. It's just like hot in Birmingham. Oh, also, and there's no public transit. There's no like sense of the public in Birmingham, or I don't know. Yeah, I don't have a good, I tried to imagine having like a strong community there, but yeah.
So how would you describe what your community looks like in either Hudson or Athens, whichever you want to talk about?
Okay. In Athens, I am blessed because I have like departmental friends from my academic life, but then I've been really lucky to have, you know, over the 8 years that I've been living there, off and on, to have seen, it's a sort of transient community because there's people who go there for university and then they move away. But when I moved back there for graduate school, I became friends with and dated this person who, is like a local musician and grew up there. And so through him, I've met so many different, either people who were born and raised in Athens, or people who are raising their families in Athens, or, you know, are like long past the kind of like post-college haze of what the hell do I do? And so my community, like I have lots of friends who work on bikes. I have lots of friends who make music. I have lots of friends who are teachers, or who work in the restaurant industry. I have friends on my block. I have, in the summers, Athens is kind of amazing because all the students leave, and it's like the joke is like you can get a parking spot downtown and you never have to wait for anything, and it's kind of amazing, and I want to go back in time to spend a little bit of summertime in Athens before the students come back, but I also just feel very at home there, just kind of like walking around, and it's like a space that I know well. And the familiar faces of, it's very bar oriented, Athens. It's like more bars per capita than any other city in the country. True story. It's like, as what Hudson is to antique shops, Athens is to bars. And there's like there's this funny geographical phenomenon there that we call the khaki line, which is like, cause it's a big Southern state school. And so there's a huge Greek culture. And so, and there's like 35,000 students at the university. And so downtown is this kind of like 4 block by 10 block like epicenter that people hang out in, although it's not everywhere that people hang out. And it's like east of the khaki line are all like the frat bars, and then west of the khaki line are like the townie bars. And and so there's a lot of bar culture. I also have a lot of friends who do organizing there, although I've kind of dropped off out of that world for a little bit because I've been trying to focus on graduate school. But there's a lot of like undocumented immigrants in Athens. There's a lot of people fighting for like black and working class liberation in Athens. There's people working in like pretty serious poverty and poverty related public health issues in Athens. And I'm lucky to be in community with some of those folks. And I used to do a lot more of that organizing, especially around immigrant justice. But I think my anxiety kind of like got a hold of me, and I needed to like take a step back to figure out some of my like what I was actually able to offer people. In Hudson, like I've lived here, like I said, since 2012. I moved up here to get an internship with this nonprofit called the Greenhorns, which is like kind of a complex nonprofit. And I moved up here because there's like a young farmer thing going on. And my sister had been coming up here. She had lived in Rhode Island in New York City, and so she'd been coming up here because there was like a young farmer thing going on. And her college best friend Elise, who now lives around the corner, had been coming up here for the young farmer thing that was going on. And the like arts connection and it just being kind of like a more easy place to be than New York City. And so Hannah and I ended up moving here full time in the same summer of 2014, right after I graduated college. And so my community here has been like, it's been mediated a lot through my sister in a lot of ways. That was kind of hard for the first few years. I also had a relationship with actually somebody who I met through my sister when I was 16. But we started dating in 2014. And so I lived here for 2 years with that partner. And we, I like didn't get out as much. I didn't. I was, okay, other detail. I was baking bread from 4 a.m. to noon on Warren Street at Bonfilio and Bread. May they rest. Well, they're in Athens now, but Athens, New York, not Athens, Georgia. So they were like across the river, but that was like the best place to go be hungover and like get a bialy. And so I worked there, and so it was really hard to like start and form relationships for the first 6 months or so that I lived here. And then I was farming, also making it kind of hard. I was usually working like 6 or 7 days a week for a long time. So I just like farming and landscaping and baking and for Bonfilio or for Talbot Narding. I worked for Ironwood Farm, which is in Philmont. And so I think it just took me a long time to get connected with people my age in this town who are like all kinds of like, you know, incredible artists and musicians and weirdos and queer folks. And like my sister opened a restaurant with her business partner Carla right before I left to go to graduate school, and it was hard to leave because they had made like such a beautiful place. But so ever since I've been coming back over the last 2 years, that's become a growing part of my community too, is that restaurant space. And I finally feel not just like I'm my sister's sister, but like I have my own kind of like relationships and anchors in this town, especially since I've left and been coming back. Yeah.
Could you describe one moment when you were like, oh, I do live here. Like this is, I live here regardless of if my sister is here, but this is where I live.
That's a really good question. I want to think about it for a second.
Yeah, we can come back to it also.
There's like a couple. Okay, there's this one time, like when I got here, there were the slow rolling kind of like, okay, like I go to Nolita's and somebody recognizes me. Or there's something also for me about like, I'm not a visual artist, and a lot of people in this community that I'm in community with are. And so I enjoyed being part of the 8 a.m. crowd and getting up and going to Nolita's in my Carhartts and hitting the road and going and landscaping for the day or going and farming for the day. And there are plenty of folks who are visual artists who also like do that kind of stuff or like, you know, work in construction. And so I liked that part of like the mornings in the valley. I really, that was something that would feel really grounding here. I think I'm also thinking about this time that I was coming back. So my first winter here was so surreal and hard. I was shuffling on like 2 inches of ice down. We lived on Rossman Street, excuse me, Rossman Street, which is up on the top of the hill above the hospital. And like 2 inches of ice to go bake bread at 4 in the morning. And so when I feel like that finally broke, I realized that I was miserable because I couldn't hack those hours, and I missed farming. I'd farmed before I moved to Hudson, and it was now farm season, so I applied to work for these women in Philmont at Ironwood Farm that I knew. And I think I was like one of the first kind of like good feelings I had about living here was one of the first warm days that it was. I remember driving from Philmont back to Hudson and coming down, what's that? It's not 60s. Maybe it was 66. Maybe I took the Fish and Game route home. And Taylor Swift's Shake It Off had just come on the radio. And I turned on my radio and I just blared that and just like could not. I just suddenly felt so, I'm not like a Taylor head or whatever, but I was just like, that song's so catchy. And I was just like dancing around my car in a tank top with the windows down, and I felt really good about that. There's other things, like other like secrets that you know when you start feeling sort of in on things, or when you get to go ice skating at the Basilica, or when you have a good dinner party. And you know, one of the real moments was when my sister used to have a lot of dinner parties, and I remember feeling like having a good conversation with somebody and not feeling like a kid. Because I was younger than a lot of people, but at the same time not. I think I was just having a lot of culture shock being in New York and being in an arts community when I think I'm pretty like creative and interesting, but I did not have like a sort of dexterity of just like conversational stylings around people who make a living in like art and design. Because I was like an organizer and I made a living in like academia and social justice stuff, but also like in like farming and dirt. And I don't know, it's complex because the farmers keep kind of different hours and than the young artists in town. Yeah, Taylor Swift, I guess, is the time I remember. God, I wish I could remember more.
That's a lot. That was great. I'm curious, I love the concept of you not needing to expand your world, but of course your world still is expanding.
Right.
But I don't know, could you talk more about what that looks like? Like, keep having your world grow, but in these places that you know?
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, okay, so maybe I'll back up a little bit, and I think part of the origins of this, like, I lived in Birmingham until I was 18. I applied to a lot of different colleges. I was a pretty gifted student, and I really wanted to go to Brown. Couldn't afford that to save my life, but like, I wanted to go to Brown because I'd been to Providence because my sister went to RISD, and I just like had like this kind of vision, and God, I don't want to go be like on record as like my sister did all, but yeah, I like was in love with Providence because it was cool and it was different. It was the only thing I'd had experience with. I got into Brown. I got into Yale. I never even went to go visit Yale. I got into Vanderbilt, which I don't even know why I applied there because what a terrible place. And then I applied to Alabama, Auburn, and Georgia. And Alabama gave me a bunch of money. It's in Tuscaloosa. It's a fine, fine place. Just fine. Auburn's maybe like slightly more country. At UGA, I got a scholarship called the Foundation Fellowship, which is like it's a kind of a ticket to ride. And I couldn't believe it. I just had never, I'd been like gifted and I went to a good school. So I was like well supported. And I also was like an intense workaholic as a kid. So I worked really hard at school. And it was one of the things that made me feel like I had like some control over my life or something, was just to work really, really hard at school. And I loved reading and learning. And so I got the scholarship that was like free ride, plus a living stipend, plus travel grant money, plus funded group travel. And so right before I went to college, my parents, My parents had had this long-standing relationship with the Episcopal Diocese of Haiti, and they'd had that relationship through the Alabama Episcopal Diocese. Parents are Episcopalians. And my parents have been going for years. I, at that point, was really interested in public health and medicine, you know, like a lot of young brainiacs, I guess. And I'd read that book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, by Paul Farmer. And Paul Farmer is like the godparents of the kids of the two, the like priest and the doctor, this married couple that my parents work with, Fritz Valdema and Carmel Valdema in Quatibouquet, Haiti. And so I was always like going to be on, like I was like wanting to go for so long. And I turned 18 in December 2009. And that was like when I was going to get a passport. But then the earthquake happened that January. And my dad was there like 3 weeks later. And he's never been the same. And I got to go that June or July. And I was only there for 10 days. And it was the most, it's like, you still even now kind of hard to talk about because I don't want to, I've just like tragedy tourism is a thing. And I know, I don't have any illusions that like I like left a mark on that place or really anybody's lives there more than were left on me. But it was like the first place that I learned that the United States had like in my name, there's a dastardly history of just like brutalizing other people's lives. In deeply material and like ideological ways. And yeah, I don't know. It was just an intense 10 days of things that, that had left a pretty deep mark on me that I don't think I want to be careful about how much detail, well, anyway. Okay, and then I went to college, like 10 days later, and my mother made me rush for sororities. And it was like, can you imagine the cognitive dissonance? I had just seen so many people living in tents, and I had worked with this guy who was outfitting people who had lost their legs in building collapses, and then like talking to people about like how they like have crawfish boils on their lawn to raise money for the Red Cross or something. And like, it gets a lot more dumb for the sorority world. Sorry, anyone who's a sorority person. But so then on top of that, I had all this grant money to travel all over the world. And all my colleagues, my like classmates were like, I'm going to use my $7,000 to go to like to spend a semester in Peru or like to spend a semester in India or to spend a semester in Bolivia or to spend a semester in Guyana. And I was just like, I can't do that. It's not okay for me to use other people's lives as like a petri dish for my own development and future like gain. And so I spent every cent of this foundation dollars working for the Sierra Club and an organization called the Real Food Challenge, just like a food justice organization that, that I still work for, and traveling all over. And I went to like basically like activist and organizing training camps and training, and then like strategic meetings and stuff so that like nobody had to pay for me to get to the strategic meeting in Chicago or in San Francisco. I could fund my own travel. And that's how I moved to Hudson for the first time. I funded my travel to come work for the Greenhorns. And so I did all kinds of things like that for 4 years. And I remember feeling kind of sad, like, did I miss an opportunity? And sometimes I still wonder, like, should I have traveled more or something? But I think that it's wrong to have a compressed sense of time about when and how you get to travel. And so I know a lot of like organizers and folks from all over the world. And I was a part of kind of the youth, I meant all over the United States, part of the youth climate movement in the United States for a couple of years. Became pretty burned out on that. What I come to see now is like a kind of toxic organizing culture. But I lived in DC for 6 months and worked for the Sierra Club's Beyond Oil campaign. I used that money to go on this like crazy trip to West Virginia. And I don't say that it's crazy because it's West Virginia and it's like, that's crazy. It's like West Virginia is an intense place, but it was crazy because I went by myself And on the way up there, I got like stranded in the middle of the woods because this road that was not a road anymore was like still on Google Maps, and it like deteriorated underneath my car, and I had to come get wenched out of the creepiest place I've ever been. It was just like next to a well and a cabin with a porch light on and no other lights on and the front door open and a well in my car in the rain at night, like on Halloween. I had to get wenched out of that place on the way up there. On the way back, I was so sleep deprived because it was like 20 degrees the whole weekend, and I was sleeping in a summer tent, and I couldn't sleep because it was so cold and wet. And so I was trying, I like decided to stay later in the day. I could have left like at 8 a.m. that day, but I stayed until 2 to go to a mountaintop removal active mine site with some of the people there. And so we stood on the lip of the mine, and it's like one of the most profound experiences of my life, I guess. And then driving home, it's like a 7-hour drive by myself, no sleep. I fell asleep at the wheel a couple of times. I can't believe I made it home. And it was terrifying. And so writing up that grant report to the University of Georgia Foundation was really amazing. It's just like, dear University of Georgia Foundation, I use this money for these reasons. Thank you so much. Screw you forever. Thank you. That kind of stuff. It was a weird place. UGA is such a weird place. It's so conservative. And yet there are people in there who really like advocate for a little bit of freedom and like and edge walking. And so I think I benefited from that a little bit. Even though by like other people's standards, by like a lot of folks in Hudson went to Oberlin or Bard or like had gender studies classes from day one. And so I think that also is something that ends up being kind of important to me, is like comparing the ways that people are radical in different places and what counts as like as transformative politics in these two different places. And you asked me like what does it mean to how are my experiences with these places like deepening, and I think there's something incredible about just okay, I'm 26 and like so I just have just begun to accrue enough time and a place to really kind of witness like how people grow over time, or to be able to I've made friends and I've kept them so that I get the honor of seeing how they change their bullshit or dived deeper into their bullshit or advanced their careers or faltered in their careers or like made something gorgeous or lost their parents or like got married or got divorced. That's been going on. And or made a kid, you know, or made a home. And so I think that's like something that is so incredible to witness. And yeah. Should I go stop that toilet from running?
I'll pause it. So I know we keep talking about places, but I'm curious, what do you think your relationship will be like to Athens once you're not in school there? And if you'll stay there?
Great question. I don't know. Thanks for hitting a very anxiety-ridden point. No, I'm just kidding. I think about that a lot. I would love to not be a student there. I've only lived there a little bit, not as a student. As an undergrad, it's like a little different. As a PhD person, I kind of feel like I am on salary and I work there, but I'm in classes. Eventually I'll have to teach students there. So the great thing about graduate school is I do feel like I've left a bit of my relationship with like being like a student And I feel more like a worker. That said, like, if I stay in Athens after my PhD, it's pretty unlikely that I would get an academic job at the university. Like, that's not necessarily true. I mean, there's, like, administrative jobs and things like that. So what I like to imagine that if I stayed, I could, like, run a business. Or my friend and I have talked about starting a landscaping company. Like two babes and a hoe or something like that. That's totally conjecture. We would never call it that. But, like, we would, like, you know, I have so many experiences from Hudson, like, just, like, schlepping a kind of, like, easy landscape company, and it's not easy, but, like, I understand, like, kind of, like, other ways to make money that I've learned from people up here, and so I think about, like, how much richer my life might be if I, had, like, wasn't doing academic projects in Athens, how much, like, socially richer it could be, or just, like, more tactily rich, like, just working with my hands and being outside more. But I think about that sometimes, and a lot of my friends are that, like, my friend Caleb is a screen printer, and he works in a shirt factory all day, and then he, like, rides mountain bikes and plays guitar, and, my friends who work in the service industry, that's a whole other thing. I mean, I have service industry experience from up here, so I think about that, but I'm also really happy, like, having a job where I'm writing and thinking, and where that's very sort of forward-looking. And so I think I would want to have a job there that was forward-looking. It'd be nice to own a business or, like, do some kind of, like, collaborative, productive project with people, or like, run a community space. Rather than, like, be sort of an administrative university worker. And sometimes, and don't tell the NSF this, but, like, I love academia. I love what I'm doing right now, but I do not know if it's a sustainable life for me, for, like, mental health reasons, for political, ethical reasons. My project deals with really complex questions of, like, race and place and land, and belonging and land ownership and, like, deep histories, and I'm trying to understand relationships between, like, agricultural land and the prison economy, and that probably doesn't need to go on record because I'll probably publish something on that at some point, but look out for that. I'm afraid of the academic future sometimes because I think it can be really isolating, and I just don't want to feel, like, isolated. I think our parents, I'm saying our because I'm looking at you and I think we might be the same age, but we're close to it, but my parents' generation, like, it's like you leave home and you start over in a new city, and then if you're lucky you make enough money that you can own a house with where you don't share it with other people than your children, and then you have a car, and then you, like, go to work in it, and then you don't bump shoulders with anybody. And that's not true of everybody's, like, that's obviously not true of, but it, like, that's what, like, success is supposed to be in the United States, especially in the South where there's no public transit, so you're not commuting by train to get to your job, driving in your air-conditioned car. And I think that has filled me with this just, like, fear of isolation. Like, I just don't want to grow up and not have conversations with people on the street. I feels like that's just, like, pathological. Like, what my parents' generation got comfortable with, and I just don't understand how any of them are okay. Like, I guess, like, you make enough money that you can, like, go on vacation or something, but they don't even do that, and they certainly didn't when I was younger, and so I don't know. Yeah, I forget what you even asked me. It was about Athens and jobs and, like, being there, not related to the university, but
Well, What do you think your understanding of isolation was when you were growing up? Like, would you have put it in that word or in those words?
No, because I had two sisters, and it was like we used to, we had a dog and some cats, and we would like run around the neighborhood. When we were really little, my parents could afford, both my parents worked, and my mom was kind of the breadwinner. And so we had babysitters, and we had like a nanny for a long time. Although I don't remember our time with her, because I'm the youngest of three. And her name was Dorothy Price, and we called her Dot Dot. And she's 92. She's a black woman. She's incredible. She's got an incredible voice. My sister is getting married in September, and we had an engagement party in Mountain Brook, and Dada was there. She and my Nana get along really well. She's like, we have like Christmas dinner together a lot with Dada, and she's kind of one of the last of her generation that's left. Her brother died recently. People in the generation below her have also, her son died in the last couple of years. And so, yeah, she's just this like incredible matriarch. And I realize also that there's so much about her that I don't know, because I was too young to like ask her very many questions, let alone remember them when she was with us more often. But because both my parents worked, she took care of us during the day. And when my mom got sick and she had basically a mental breakdown when I was a small child, and so we lost a lot of our financial stability, because my mom, like I said, had been the breadwinner. And I think my parents weren't anticipating that, so we were also, from what I understand, we were also in a lot of debt, and owned a really expensive house, and our house was on the market for like 8 years, I feel like it was. We finally sold it when I was in second grade. So I always had siblings around me, and we had, you know, attention from my parents and stuff, but I think it wasn't until when I was 11, our middle sister Lucy died of AML, acute myelogenous leukemia, in an incident of having leukemia that she might as well have been hit by a car for like how fast it took. We just didn't know she was sick, and then she got sick, and then the next day she died. And Hannah was like 16 and I was like 11. And so Hannah went to college. And so from 13 on, I had gone from being the youngest of three to an only child until I was 18. So like 5 years of just me and my parents. And Hannah went to college in Rhode Island. And I think, I won't speak for her, but she didn't come home very often, in part because it was far away and college was expensive, but another part, like, why would she like come back to Alabama? But I actually wrote my college application essays about that experience of like going from being like a trio, like Hannah, Lucy, Sarah, a brunette, a redhead, and a blonde, to being like, to just having to kind of be alone. And I think my parents did a decent job navigating that. You know, they were very like communicative with me. I think I was young enough that I was pretty plastic about it, so I could like continue to, I don't know, you know, we could talk about it. It wasn't like a teen brain that experienced that kind of trauma. It was still kind of like a kid brain, and so I moved through it in, I guess, a way that was affected by my age. But and I also feel like I've kind of witnessed more of my parents, like their insecurities, their flaws, their sort of triumphant like crazy skills and also their like real, real shortcomings. And so I've seen them talk about the friends that they have and the friends that they don't feel like they have. I've seen them, you know, every night of the week for a long time. I've seen them like have their whole house get filled up with flowers and casseroles because their kid just died. And then I've seen, you know, that not happen anymore. And then I've seen the life that like my sister's cultivated for herself, which is just full of people are always around. And like, it's friend, you know, it's, you live around the corner from your friends. And I love that about Hudson. And I love that about Athens, like that it's just the, like on your block, you know, people. Whereas we lived, when we were little kids, we lived, I mentioned that we sold our house, or we moved when I was like in eighth grade, from this big house that my parents had put a lot of work into, to a house that was like on a neighborhood where we would like go and play, and we were like kind of near the schools and stuff, and there was like kids on the neighborhood, and my best friend in the whole world lived like at the other end of the street. Although she was like never able to come over to our house because it was never clean enough for my parents to feel comfortable having guests. And also my mom had a lot of health issues. So I was always going over there. And then in second grade, we moved to this other neighborhood that was like further south. And it was in what's called like an, I think it's called like estate zoning or something. It's like big, big houses on big pieces of land. So we moved to like a 2-acre plot that was, you know, worth like a quarter of what we sold our last house for. And I think my parent, that was like a good situation for my parents, but we were five people in a 2-bedroom house. And it's this weird house that had like a, such a weird, my parents still live there on Caldwell Mill Road. And it's like this 2-story house, but the whole bottom floor is a basement. And then the whole, and it's pretty big, but like the whole second floor, it's like you walk in with this long driveway that kind of comes up the hill, and then there's like a little like round, like big parking zone, and then it's surrounded by really tall trees, including an enormous like cedar tree, and then like 80-foot poplar trees and pine trees and like oak leaf hydrangeas everywhere and just crazy birds everywhere. And it's this kind of snaking driveway, and then the house is this like brown kind of weird like Alabama mid-century modern thing going on. It's got like a like shed roof that kind of like bucks back and forth in a couple different directions. So on one side of the house and one part of the house, it'll be like a 8-foot ceiling. On the other side, it's like a 16-foot ceiling. And it's cool now. When we moved there, it smelled like old wood and old lady. And it was full of like old weird artifacts from this couple who had lived there before, and they had either like left, or I'm not sure if they died. I wish I could remember her name. And there was like a big stone hearth in the middle, but it was like non-functional, and it had all those strange things. We had five people, 2 bathrooms that were clearly a his and her bathroom for the prior couple that lived there. One was green, one was pink. There was one shower that conjoined the 2 bathrooms. So you could walk into the shower and then walk out the other side into either the pink or green bathroom. And so when we had a shower, we had to hang towels on either side of the shower to have a little bit of privacy from our family, because if anybody needed to pee, they would just like be right next to the shower. And there was like a bathtub that we never used. And I remember one summer, a tornado twisted off the top of this 80-foot poplar tree and just like dropped it straight down into that bathroom. And we had like repainted and stuff. My dad's really handy, so we've made some changes, but it destroyed that bathroom while my dad was trying to remodel the other bathroom, just like on his own, like pulling it together. And he had this cool idea. I mean, my parents, God love them, for as cash strapped as we are, they really care about aesthetics, and like they have put together this really like beautiful, like, well, you know, they've got good, really good taste, and sometimes I'm like, really, like, we spent money on this, but like, they've got nice stuff now, and it's because they like kind of piece by piece like knit it together over, you know, when did we move there? I guess 20 years that we lived there. And so that bathroom was under construction. This bathroom now had a tree in it. And so it was several days. I think we like showered at a neighbor's house or something and then like got the tree removed and then got insurance money to finish one bathroom and then finish the other. And now it's like we have these incredible bathrooms because of insurance money and also because my dad is an architect, so he gets like deals on stuff. So when people come over to my parents' house now, I'm just like, this is not how we grew up. We did not have a tub with jets. We did not have a shower with a little like sauna thing. That was like my shower as a kid literally was growing mushrooms, like caps. Like I picked a couple out of the floor because the wood was so water damaged. And it's like I didn't have my own bedroom growing up. The only reason I got my own bedroom is because my sister died. And like the only reason Hannah got her own bedroom is because Hannah, my dad, built one out of like this weird living room space that they had. But it's this incredible long house where from one end of it, like my parents' bedroom and my bedroom shared a wall at the back end of the house. And you could stand like with your back to the window, like at the back edge of the house and look all the way down to the other edge of the house. This like long hallway that goes through the kitchen, that goes through the living room, that goes to the outside. And so and these huge bays of windows that like overlook the driveway, and there's like a creek, and then some neighbor's mansion, and then another neighbor's mansion. And our house was like the dog of the neighborhood. And it was a totally fine, totally safe place to live. But we couldn't walk, you know, we left our neighborhood where all of our friends lived. And it was kind of just us all of a sudden. We used to have a tree house. My dad built us a tree house at our old place. And then now we had a basement, but it was kind of creepy. And so when my sister left or got older so that she could drive and stuff, in the summers, my parents both worked. And I would stay home. And I was, like, terrified of burglars. I was home alone a lot in the summers, just, like, watching TV and kind of waiting for, like, things to happen because I couldn't walk anywhere. And I couldn't drive anywhere for sure. But I would like sometimes call my friends and we would talk on the phone. But I definitely also watched a lot of TV, which is, you know, I sometimes wonder about how that affected my brain. I would try to read, or I would like try to make schedules for myself, and I just couldn't do it. I was like way too, just that's not a form of discipline that I have or particularly care to have. So I just like... But it was kind of a stressful time, and that's part of why I really loved school, was because it was like I was not at home, and there were people around, and so when I was in high school, I did like was editor of the newspaper, co-editor in chief of the newspaper. I was like big deal on the track team, kinda. Didn't do anything sexy. Wasn't like a hurdler. I was a shot put thrower, but I was like a state champion, like medal earning like shot put thrower, and I have my high school's record. I threw discus and stuff. And then I did tech theater. So there were some weeks where I was like, big ass track meet, big ass newspaper, plays coming out. And I was like from at school from like 7 a.m. until 11 p.m. And I don't know that I loved it, but it was like kept me sane. So I don't know. Yeah. Isolation. It just has mattered to like have people around, and also to like just bear witness to people and not be insecure about how messy and weird you are. And like, like when you can like trust somebody to kind of witness your whole self in a way that's like not like abusive or manipulative or something like that, but just like you get to be yourself and be seen. I think that's like one of the most kind of profound gifts that we can give each other.
So you've described a lot of selves during this, like who you are in Athens and Hudson, not that they're necessarily different, but I'm wondering if they do feel different, and you described who you were in high school, and just if you want to talk about that.
Oh my God. I read something recently that kind of changed my life. It's by Maria Lugones, Argentinian decolonial feminist, I think like lesbian separatist. No, I won't put that on her. I shouldn't say that. But like queer woman. Anyway, she wrote this piece called like Split Separation about the experience of having multiple selves, always ongoing, simultaneous multiplicity, and like not needing to kind of clean up our sense of selves into kind of linear or like coherent internal narratives about being one person at any time. Which it was really cool from like a philosophical level, although I have like very much felt like it's hard to have faith in the idea that I have like multiple selves. I think one of the things that's kind of defining about me that's hard to talk about is that I think I was raised in a pretty anxious environment. I think my mother was pretty sick. I think we were told that we were very broke. I think my mother had bipolar disorder. My dad was like a dad, like a Southern white man doing truly the very best he could. Both my parents did. And to like guide us through like a very, and me in particular, cause I was around for much longer, through like a lot of trauma. But somehow I ended up with just like a pretty serious anxiety situation that I didn't really know how to talk about until, I didn't know that it was not necessarily normal until recently. But there's ways that it was like nurtured in me and ways that I was also born with it. Like way before like it should have been apparent, I was deeply afraid of getting in trouble, and I experienced so much anxiety about like things like getting up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. I would like wake my parents up and ask for permission, which is crazy. Like my parents should have taught me to stop waking them up because it's annoying. But I don't know, it's not like I have a accurate kind of memory of that, but or I was procrastinate on homework, and then I would just have these like panic attacks about school, and my mom would like get me to lay down and like tell me to like give all of my worries to her, and she would give them to God. And I was like, fuck off. Like, that's not going to help. Like, I got to make this B model to present in class tomorrow. And somehow I didn't do it. Or I was always losing things. I was always very scattered. I lost 6 retainers. I don't know why my parents kept buying me retainers or how. Like, where the fuck did that money come from? And I would just, like, I was always losing the most important thing. And I got to this point where I was so good at hiding it that I would just live with this dread that I would get found out that I lost my retainer or I lost like my wallet or like I would just like, I was just too afraid to look for things. So I would just lived with this kind of dread, and I would lay in bed at night and wish upon a star for 2 things. 1, to be thin, because you know, it's hard being a girl. 2, to have a magic power that I could scan, you know, the 360 in all directions, and the thing that I was missing would like have a homing beacon and I could go find it, or I would know that it was like in Mississippi or something, instead of like in Alabama, or I would just know what the hell happened to it. So I think I've just like always been really anxious and scattered, and that has always had a kind of big impact on my sense of self, because I've just been like, okay, well, why is it so hard for me to make friends? And other people might say that it doesn't seem like it's hard for me to make friends, but I had this like really overwhelming internal narrative that, you know, people in my life would be like, can't you just stop? Like my sister would be like, why don't you just not think that way? And I couldn't not think negative things about myself. I didn't know how. It had not been modeled to me. I didn't know what that kind of internal dialogue would sound like. And it was like this well-carved out groove or like rutted out path in my brain to just like feel really shitty about myself all the time. And so like I did a lot of things to try to feel better, or like, you know, I tried to work to like feel like myself. Or I tried to become an activist to, like, feel like myself. Or follow in it my, like, this, like, crazy love adventure that kind of brought me to Hudson. I didn't really talk about how I kind of moved to Hudson for a boy, but I kind of did. And like, okay, well, maybe, like, who I am is I'm a farmer now. And I don't know. When I moved back to Georgia, I had kind of not a lot of evidence that the life that I had led in New York for 2 years as an adult, which were some of the most challenging in my life because I was just, like, broke and didn't know who I was and stuff like that, and really depressed, really, really, really depressed. The worst, like, there's some days that I couldn't do much but just, like, watch Dance Moms, and I couldn't afford therapy, and I, like, didn't know how to get help, and there weren't people in network, the people that I was close, I, like, didn't know how to talk to anybody about it, and but it was bad. I was, like, in a bad place. And when I moved back to Athens, like, I got into graduate school, was, like, kind of this way forward that felt a bit like me kind of taking control of my life for the first time. And which is also kind of funny, because it was like, again, it's like I went back to a place I'd already lived. Instead, I could have moved to Minnesota, where I was offered, like, more money and arguably, like, a much more prestigious place, and like start fresh. But I went back and I moved a block away from where I'd lived 2.5 years ago, where I'd met this person that I was in a relationship with that I loved so much, who I was breaking up with because our relationship was just, like, not working. So I moved 2 blocks away from that old place on Pope Street in Athens, Georgia, where I live now. I live in this barn. And I never lived alone. And so I was just, like, all of a sudden alone. And Al and I were breaking up. I was starting graduate school. I had very little evidence that I had lived in New York at all, except my driver's license, which I kept, which I just, like, ensured that I kept a New York State driver's license, because it was, like, it just, like, I was, like, okay, it did happen. I did do that, and I did become that person. I don't know what to make of that statement, but I did, like, have those experiences, and I did survive that challenge, and I did meet all those people, and they're still there. And I started, where do I want to go with this? I think, oh, right. So I moved into this psycho barn that is, like, that was kind of a big recruitment tool for why I moved back to Georgia, is because my dear friend had been living there, and he hooked me up with this, like, barn situation, and we but he was, like, hadn't really moved out, and it was full of roaches. It was so hot. It was, like, an insane, fully insane place to live, where it was just, like, not sealed. You can see daylight through the walls. There was, like, a cat-sized hole in the eaves. None of this, I knew it was rustic, but I didn't realize how rustic. And it was this, like, 3-month process of me, like, getting, like, just going a little crazy in the barn and, like, trying to start graduate school, but being so distracted by the roaches that I couldn't read. And I had to, like, teach myself how to read under these conditions. And, like, it was too hot to sleep in the rafters for the first few months. So I slept on the couch, like, cocooned in a little blanket. And then I moved up to the rafters. And the first night I slept up there, I heard the mice and the squirrels that move around in the walls at night. And it was, like, I thought, I called it some kind of, like, unholy scuttling. It was just, like, the whole barn is insulated with styrofoam, a lot of which is exposed as the ceiling. And so you hear, can you imagine, like, little rodent claws on styrofoam? It's just, like, it's so crazy. And it woke me up at 3 a.m. and I was just like, trying to find a flashlight to figure out if there's a bat in my space or something. And I hung, like, a mosquito net so I didn't have to worry about cockroaches. So, like, I felt safe in this, like, mosquito net. But I did all of these things to reclaim the barn. I took all the furniture out. I mopped and vacuumed the floors. I met a man who I kind of fell in love with, who brought a repellent gun and shot the squirrels that would come out of the nest. And then he would take them and clean them and use their tails for, he's making a vest out of squirrel tails. Deep South, y'all. And I like, there's this weird dust that like falls out of the ceiling that is like definitely like decade. This barn is 120 years old. Like all kinds of crazy, like decades of like insect and animal poo dust. And it was would like the one of the worst parts that it would fall out was over my bed. So I got a drop cloth and I like stapled it against the rafters and made this like kind of actually decent looking drop cloth ceiling and arranged the furniture just so and like acquired my own things. And I finally, it was the first time I'd ever like had my own house. And I was living by myself, which was kind of hard, but I had friends over a lot. And I just like fought like hell to make this space mine. And mine and the squirrels a little bit, like they're, you know, and like make peace with them, like just be like, that's your zone, they don't wake me up anymore if I have guests stay over. It's like, just be aware they're not inside the space, they're just in the walls and they're just doing their thing, and they're not gonna hurt you. And so now I feel like I had an opportunity recently to move out of the barn and move in with some roommates in this house with like four rooms with like nice walls that are sealed and like nice morning light and an equally like historic and beautiful house. And I thought about it for so long. I was so torn thinking like, oh, it could be amazing to like have a tub and a porch, but I was like, I can't, I'm not done like living in this barn. And so I think in this the most recent years I fought really hard to get comfortable being alone with myself, or just like with myself. I spent thousands of dollars of student loan money on therapy, and I really learned how to love myself on my own terms, and to not like, I learned for the first time that like you don't have to, if you think that you suck, it's not because you do, like, you know what I mean, like, or if you think, if you feel negative thoughts, it's not because that's what, that things are bad. It could just be that you actually can encourage and invite yourself to think about it a little differently and support and like be the kind of like, be like parent yourself around that, where you think like, oh, like I feel insecure because there's a part of me that's wounded. And if I just like take care of that wound, like I would want to take care of my kid. And I like honor that wounded place, then you can approach yourself with like a lot more love. And I think because of that, I've spent the last few years like really working on getting to that place. And it's just been fun to kind of get to know myself that way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Should we be done?
Yeah, I think that will be the end. But
we don't need to tag again.
No. Do you feel like we need to?
Do you want? Let's do it. Let's sign off.
Okay, we're going to sign off. This is Matilda Ostow. I just had the deepest pleasure of talking with Sarah Black, and we're sitting in her house on Clinton Street in Hudson, New York, and it's still May 18th, 2018. And Sarah, can you just give us your voice?
This is Sarah Thomas Black, signing off.